Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
So remember last night, he made that distinction between the bonum commune, common good, and bona communia for you Latin, you know, scholars. That's a great example of a second declension neuter, right? At the A ending there. Didn't we see last night that it's not a common good because there weren't enough seats for all of us, right? That because some of us were in there, some of us had to struggle to find a place to be. So thinking about just war, isn't that a good image there, that the common good may require that we give up common goods, you know, things that are good for us as a community, we may have to sacrifice. And in some cases, while we can never intend the death of innocent people, of our own soldiers, we recognize we do risk their lives, right? And the lives of other people who will be affected by violence. And so these things that are good, common goods, right, have to sometimes be given up. And that's part of the tragedy of war. So what I'm going to do in this talk, I mean, so I'm also reminded it is Valentine's Day, formerly the Feast of St. Valentine, no longer part of the universal calendar. So I'll have to kind of sort through how does Valentine fit into this. But that the goal of war is peace, and peace in the highest sense, as we're going to talk about this morning, is the fruit of love. So there's maybe is a good connection there between them. How are we going to get St. Cyril and Methodius in there? We'll figure out some way. But I am Byzantine Catholic, and so they are the spiritual fathers for Eastern Christians. So maybe there's some connection to maybe in that. But what I'm going to do here is sometimes it's helpful to understand our commitments by looking at alternatives to them, by looking at flawed alternatives. So what are the alternatives to just war thinking? So that's what we're going to be looking at, and that'll help us also to clarify as we get to 20th century and into today that just war theory, in a way, is the theory that everybody seems to be agreeing upon, and yet there are secular versions of it that have some merit but also are problematic in other ways. And then there's this Catholic intellectual tradition that still stands, and so I'm going to make an argument or point out flaws with this secular approach, even if it's to be lauded that there is a common commitment to this. So we only have 4,000 years of history to cover in 40 minutes, so that should be no problem at all. Let's do our best. Fortunately, I'm not an historian, so I'm probably not aware of all the ways I'm making big gaps in here. Okay, so the handout, I will be referring to that. We won't read all of the quotes in there, but we will be going in that order. Introduction then, peace is the end and is twofold. It's an odd thing to discover that Aquinas' treatment of just war theory is found in his treatise on love or charity. We can understand why this is so when we grasp this fundamental point that we must look to the end always. If war is ever to be justified, it must be based on its being directed to the proper end and by the use of means appropriate to that end. So let's start our discussion by pointing to the end or the goal of war. And on this first point, I'd encourage you to listen to Father Cajetan Cuddy's TI podcast on this subject. He goes into more detail on the locus, the text that Aquinas provides here. So quote A, peace is the work of justice indirectly, insofar as justice removes the obstacles to peace, but it is the work of charity directly, since charity, according to its very nature, causes peace. For love is a unitive force, and peace is the union of the appetites' inclinations. We always need to focus on the end in life as a whole, and specifically in discussing just war. Peace is the result of charity. It is the rest we achieve when we are united to God, united within ourselves, and united to our neighbors as ourselves. It is this harmony, the being in tune with God and his creation. And this, as Father Irenaeus reminds us today, this is the universal common good, God, to which each nation's common good is ordered. While violence may at times be necessary to achieve this, sometimes the violent bear it away. The means to the end of peace must be compatible with love of God and neighbor as self. In a qualified or analogous way, we can call the unity among persons who share the same appetites or desires, even if they themselves are not wholly in union with God, and thus their souls are not internally united, we could still call that peace and recognize that as the direct work of justice. This is bodily or political or earthly peace. Aquinas calls it concord. If you look at quote B there, concord denotes union of appetites among various persons, while peace denotes, in addition to this union, the union of the appetites even in one man. We're going to have to continue to call that peace, because that's what, when we talk about just war theory, and that's what the world uses that term peace, but we want to always remind ourselves that this is an imperfect and imitative kind of peace. When a war is fought, whether we are virtuous or vicious, we all desire freedom from fear, from pain, from death, and hope for an end to violence. Look at quote C. I'm not going to read that, but Aquinas goes over that, that even the warmonger, even the vicious person, is seeking a kind of peace. Aquinas reminds us here again that even among the wicked and violent, there is this desire. So the just war theory that's our focus this morning is rooted in this recognition of the goal of human life, the peace of the beatific vision, and that those who go to war unjustly, and especially those who advocate for war without any moral boundaries, are making themselves miserable. In justice and in charity, we will their good by seeking to illuminate the truth. So that Old Testament reading from the Mass really stood out to me, that Jeroboam does not want the people's hearts to be turned. That was the expression, hearts to be turned, if they go and worship rightly. So he wants to keep them from God. I mean, that's his direct intention, is to prevent them from God. So in this talk, we will approach just war by looking at the history of theorizing about war and divide this up into five stages. That'll help us take this 4,000 years and break it up into periods and also into ideas, because some of these ideas are alive and well today. Section two then, the first stage is holy war. Both in Jewish and in Gentile or pagan forms, the holy war approach takes for granted that we, the belligerents, are the righteous ones because we fight on behalf of God or the gods. As the chosen people, we do God's will in enslaving or obliterating our enemies. The will of the God takes the place of justice, or perhaps we can say that justice is doing the will of the God, a position that Plato in Euthyphro so successfully problematizes. If the gods are capricious, then could the gods will something that is unjust? In this quote from Deuteronomy, we see an Old Testament version of this. I'm not going to read it, but we do want to note that God does tell them to save alive nothing that breathes, you know, men, women, and children. And so for Christians too, this is a challenge. You can see why divine command theory, which was a popular kind of an alternative, let's say, to a scholastic Thomistic approach, would have some attraction to various Christians. Our focus is not how to square these hard sayings with the fact that this is the word of God we're reading here. We could briefly say that the point here is for God to prepare a people that is righteous and through whom all people will in the fullness of the time of Jesus Christ be redeemed. In the end, God is not on our side against their side. Rather, God invites those on all sides to be on his side. And secondly, we do not deny that God has the authority to take the lives of us fallen sons and daughters of Adam and Eve. Rather, we deny that under the covenant given to us in Christ, he authorizes humans to kill on his behalf outside of the limited circumstances that we're going to be talking about, self-defense, and when commanded by political authority for the sake of the common good. Second stage, Greco-Roman just war. The second stage, which we could say is anticipated in Homer, is developed by the Greek and then the Roman philosophers. Here we bring to the fore the question of whether or not we are the just ones. and also what we owe to enemies given our shared humanity. It is often said that the ancients glorified warrior culture. Read the Iliad and Odyssey for yourself and see if that's true. Because I don't. We often see Homer, in the midst of relating the actions of the battle, focus on a Greek and a Trojan, the two combatants. He tells us their backstories, ends with the terrible recognition that when they are unstrung, which is the image that's used, their fathers, mothers, wives, and children will never see them again, whether they're Greeks or Trojans. Doesn't matter. In some sense, then, just war theory is present in Homer, but it's the philosophers who develop it in reacting to this arbitrary will of the gods idea that the pagan culture around them has, and in their discovery of the natural justice that is higher than human law. Plato and Aristotle, the great names here, but it's the Roman Cicero who provides us with the clearest statement of just war principles. Writing during the rise of Caesar and the end of the Republic, he is a central source for Aquinas' virtue ethics more broadly, the four cardinal virtues, and Aquinas' account of natural law, as well as the common good, by the way. So he's a very important source. Note in this quote A how Cicero lets the chosen people idea fade into the background as he focuses on the universal moral obligations each political community has. This is worth reading in full because we can see so many principles in it. The rights of war must be strictly observed. We must resort to force only in case we may not avail ourselves of discussion, that we may live in peace unharmed. No war is just unless it is entered upon after an official demand for satisfaction has been submitted or warning has been given and a formal declaration made. If under stress of circumstances individuals have made any promises to the enemy, they are bound to keep their word even then. Both the fox or fraud and the lion or force are wholly unworthy of man, but fraud is the more contemptible. Of all forms of injustice, none is more flagrant than that of the hypocrite, who at the very moment when he is most false makes it his business to appear virtuous. You've got to remember this image here because it's going to come back in the fourth stage of thinking about war. While Cicero does not develop a systematic just war theory, he lays out some of the fundamental principles. Last resort, peace is the end, maintenance of morality even towards enemies. Section 4, the third stage, Christian development of just war theory. As we turn to this third stage, it's important to start with two points here. First, just war theory is a matter of reason, not faith. It's a philosophical recognition of the natural law at work among peoples that harmonizes with and cannot be built upon by faith. So think of how easily people want to say, those are matters of faith, and so they're not to be taught in a public institution. This is from reason. We're talking about what human nature and reason reveal to us about the obligations we have to one another. A second point is that unlike that Old Testament passage, which needs to be brought to the fullness of truth in Christ, and unlike the way that Islam thinks about violence and war, Christianity has a difficult time justifying any violence, especially taking up the sword. Think of Matthew 26, those who take up the sword perish by it. It'll take the church 400 years after Christ before it's ready to think through the fundamental distinctions that can justify Christians fighting in wars at all. And if they can fight, only within these very certain parameters that are more limited than those of Roman law. St. Augustine is the central figure here. And in his letter to Boniface and against Faustus, he works through such passages as Matthew 8, Jesus marveling at the faith of the centurion, Ephesians 6, armor of God, belt of truth imagery, and Romans 13, God gives secular authorities the sword, to establish the Christian additions to just war theory, placing reason in the service of faith. We can isolate four distinctly Christian contributions to just war theory, followed by two distinct additions that Aquinas gives us. First, render unto Caesar, render under God distinction. That's quote A under 4. I'm not going to read that quote, but that's a really fascinating and interesting, important one for a Christian understanding of this. The earthly peace, again, Aquinas calls it concord, we spoke about, requires bodily warfare. When we engage in a war, we're not fighting a holy war for God, but instead we're rendering unto Caesar, and we're directing that to the love of God and neighbor as self. Second, to be clear, to make war secular or about justice rather than holiness is not to secularize it in a pejorative sense. We mean this actually as a positive thing. But to indicate instead its subordination to spiritual warfare. Again, Ephesians 6, armor of God, belt of truth. The second contribution of Christianity then is to establish a spiritual, a church hierarchy, body of Christ, separate from the secular authority or government that looks over the moral requirements of war rather than the bodily well-being of the community. Third, by establishing this body of bishops, priests, and religious, it also reduces the number of available combatants to the sovereign, as well as limits the number of day for heading off to war. So the Third Lateran Council in 1179, Canon 21, excommunicated anyone who violated truces. So you got to think this through. When can you go to war following this? You cannot go to war from after sunset on Wednesday until sunrise on Monday. So when can you go? And from Advent until the octave of the Epiphany, you can't go to war then. And from Septuagesima until the octave of Easter. So that was, you were excommunicated if you went to war during those times. That's a large part of the year. Now, how effective was it? That's another question. But at least the intention here is to pull back on it. Okay, so fourth thing is that Christianity, actually, quickly, notice it roughly corresponds to football season, so that's when you can't go to war. So it's a great way to think about football. It's, we can't go to war. We got to come up with something else to do during this period, and so we can watch football on Sunday and that sort of thing. Okay, in addition, this is the fourth thing, Christianity seeks to extend the moral formation to all people, universal call to holiness, rather than just the elites. Cicero's talking to elites, right? He's not talking to everybody. Those people, they don't do the thinking. They're like the linemen. We send them in and they do that. We just tell them what to do, right? That's not the Christian approach, right? That everyone has to be formed morally. Now, the two contributions of Aquinas I'm going to highlight are, first, he clearly articulates its essence, the three criteria, and its characteristics or qualities, especially the distinction between jus ad bellum, the right to go to war, and jus in bello, the right in the war. Okay, so remember last night Father Aquinas talked about when we try to find the common good, we easily start with these characteristics and qualities. That's not the essence of it, but that can help us get to it. So Aquinas is great at helping us do that. I'm not going to read this long passage, but you should have it, because this is the place Aquinas lays it out. So three criteria for jus ad bellum: sovereign authority, a just cause, and rightful intention. In terms of jus in bello, so now that we're in a war, what is morally acceptable and what's not? He talks about how clerics cannot fight in wars. That's one of them. We'll actually talk about, perhaps get at that later, and that only necessary military actions can take place on holy days. I'm actually going to dwell on that one in the next lecture. So what if those holy days, you're not allowed to go to war, so you're attacked. Can we fight back? Or are we not allowed to do that? Quote C, again, not going to read that, but for your reference. So Augustine Aquinas, this is an important moral point, that lying is an intrinsic moral evil. So even to enemies, we can't lie to them. We can't break truces with them unless they've broken them first and so forth. But he makes a distinction then between declaring the truth and withholding information, right? We don't tell, hey, what's your military strategy? We're not obligated to tell that, right? We can withhold information. But that is very difficult to think through in war. What is, in terms of strategies and things that might seem deceptive and that sort of, that Aquinas is very strict on that, and that's a severe limitation. The second contribution of Aquinas is placing just war theory in the virtue ethics tradition, most importantly with the emphasis on prudence. This allows us to distinguish between the necessary theoretical conditions of a just war as distinct from the prudential question. Here and now, ought we go to war? And if so, how do we fight it? While he does not develop such criteria that are now standard, which we're going to talk about later on, proportionality, last resort, so forth. His analysis of the virtues and these prudential considerations that guide moral decision-making laid the groundwork for a tradition that extends at least as far as Francisco de Vitoria, who's writing in the early 1500s, the school of Salamanca, ending with the Spanish Jesuits, like Suarez, up to St. Robert Bellarmine in the early 1600s. So I'm not saying that's the end of that tradition, but those are major figures in develop. Aquinas says very little, actually. It's very small, whereas these thinkers really develop all of these other criteria for thinking about war. Fourth stage, modern Machiavellianism and the attempted neutrality of social science coupled with international law. In this fourth stage, we see a bad form of secularization. It's actually really a secularized version of holy war. Our prince, republic, or nation is unquestionably right, or perhaps even above morality, when we seek our own interest. Machiavelli initiates what later becomes the state of nature approach. The ends justify the means because there is no justice between princes, republics, and nations. Here are some examples of what is sometimes called realism in politics, realpolitik. Okay, remember that Cicero quote. So this is 1,500 years later, and Machiavelli knew the Roman thinkers very well. Quote A, many have pictured republics and principalities which in fact have never been known or seen. Yet he who neglects what is done for what ought to be done sooner affects his ruin rather than his preservation. For a man who wishes to act entirely up to his professions of virtue soon meets with what destroys him among so much that is evil. Hence it is necessary for a prince wishing to hold his own to know how to do wrong and to make use of it or not according to necessity. So notice utility or necessity becomes now the measure of what's allowed. Quote B, you must know that there are two ways of contesting, the one by the law, the other by force. The first method is proper to men, the second to beasts. But because the first is frequently not sufficient, it is necessary to have recourse to the second. A prince, therefore, being compelled knowingly to adopt the beast, ought to choose the fox and the lion. Therefore, it is unnecessary for a prince to have all the good qualities I have enumerated, fidelity, friendship, humanity, religion, but it is very necessary to appear to have them. Notice he's exactly disagreeing with Cicero. It's even following the same order. I do want to pause to mention this, thinking about historical example for us. General Sherman is often used in the U.S., think of war is hell, war is cruelty and you cannot refine it, as an example of a kind of Machiavellianism. I think Sherman can at least partially be defended. That's very complicated. We could talk through it at some point. And especially those of you at West Point, it's really worth reading an article that goes over the curriculum in the 1830s in 1840s that Sherman and Robert E. Lee and so many other Civil War leaders would have received. So I can give you the reference. It's Military Ethics of General Sherman by John Brinsfield, who was a history professor at West Point in the 80s. And he's actually now a retired military chaplain, has a very good book of diaries of Civil War chaplains, unions and Confederate. Really helpful in thinking how chaplains had this moral role in the war. Okay, so there's so many figures in this tradition that we would need to think through, and they don't all agree among themselves. Grotius, Puffendorf, Wolff, Vattel, Lieber, James Kent, Jomini, and so forth. I mean, that's a huge area that we don't get to explore, but I think my general concern holds for them. The rise of modern science, perhaps not intentionally, feeds into this amoral approach to war by restricting its study of human nature to description rather than prescription of what happens. And relying, secondly, on international law to set limits to what may be rightly or legally done. Let me provide a really shocking example of this. Hugo Grotius, often considered the father of international law, tells us that intentional killing of women and children is permitted in war. Wow, that's shocking. But then he goes on to say, by permitted, I only mean legally, not morally. It's really helpful, right? He's laying out that if you're just following the law, you're tolerating things that cannot be tolerated. The beast, that's the beast that Machiavelli talks about. If we remove morality from our scientific analysis of war, we're left with Machiavellianism. Do whatever is permitted by your society in order to achieve your goals. While this attempt to analyze war scientifically may not intend to deny that there's a moral end of human nature, it often replaces moral language with the language of self-interest, advantage, or legality. The most famous theorist of military science is Karl von Clausewitz, who's writing in the early 1800s, and he's explicitly built upon by our own U.S. Marines manual, Warfighting. And just to mention again back to the West Point formation and the Civil War formation, it'd be interesting to look at Virginia Military Institute. I mean, Stonewall Jackson would be the person, but he was largely self-taught, so he didn't, it's hard to know. I don't know at least enough about what he would have been looking at. But at West Point, it was Vernon's Treatise on the Science of War and Fortifications. The preface to that had a really Hobbesian state of nature kind of analysis, right? That in nature, there's no justice. This was supplemented by William Paley, who's a Christian utilitarian ethicist. And even the professor, Sherman's professor, tried to use a different book. He was denied that. He was forced to use this book. And he says, quote, that it taught the young men that they have no conscience. It diminishes their respect for truth and perplexes if it does not confound the distinction between right and wrong. So that was his own analysis of the book he was required to teach in the moral philosophy class at that time. So here's what Clausewitz says. Look at C, D, and E. The principal moral elements, notice he calls them moral elements, are the skill of the commander, the experience and courage of the troops, and their patriotic spirit. So when he uses the word moral, I think he really means more like morale. So it's like morality has been replaced with, you know, esprit de corps and morale and so forth. The next quote, the essence of war is a violent struggle between two hostile, independent, and irreconcilable wills, each trying to impose itself on the other. And then in quote E, the object in war is to impose our will on our enemy. So notice that justice, rightful intention, have just been removed from his definition of war. Let's first point out that justice is willing the good of the other, not imposing our will on the enemy. So maybe in football, we can try to impose our will on the enemy's line, right? That's the way we talk about that situation. But when we're talking about actual violence, we have to really think about justice. Second, if we attempt to defend this approach by arguing that it does not necessitate a denial of moral considerations in war, I'm not saying that von Clausewitz was an amoralist. I'm not saying that. We also have to see this, though, as returning to the pagan approach in which only the elite are given a moral formation. So Sherman and others are receiving a moral formation largely through their Christian upbringing. Sherman is interesting. His wife is Catholic. He eschews this. And so there's that kind of question. Well, what's actually guiding his moral thinking on this? While it is in a way true that moral responsibility lies with the political or military authority who commands the action, each soldier still bears moral responsibility and must be given a moral formation in order to discern the proper limits of obedience. This would be worth discussing more fully in the Q&A if you're interested, especially in light of recent claims that soldiers can conscientiously refuse to obey orders if they think that a war is unjust. This has been claimed about Greenland and other military situations of our own military as well. So it is worth, obviously, very important to explore this. What are the limits of obedience to a command? But that could have to come out later. But I think that this modern approach, even if it doesn't deny morality, private morality, it's still just this reversion to a pagan culture that says, we'll leave the elites to think about it. Okay, fifth stage, just war revival. So that gets us up for the last 200 years up to today. Going back to the mid-19th century and solidified after World War II, the Geneva Conventions have sought to provide limitations to what can be done in a war, using bailo. And so as well, in the Civil War, the Union formulates the Lieber Code, which was a code on what was allowed in the war, because now you're beginning to break down civilian soldier distinctions. And then, of course, thinking about Sherman's march to the sea. So this is happening. It's not as if it's a total free-for-all. More generally, there's been a broad revival in both secular and religious liberal and conservative circles to reestablish just war theory as a guide to modern society. Michael Walzer's 1977 book, Just and Unjust Wars, and the reference is in the footnote there, is a seminal text in a secular liberal approach, as in left-wing politically. Moderate, I think he's pretty moderate, actually. And he highlights, I think, I would argue, the problem with the value-free approach of social science. But in the very act of formulating the problem of this social science approach, he also kind of reveals the problem for someone like him who can't rely upon a higher morality. Look at quote A. We, his generation, this is after Vietnam, he's writing, right, suffered from an education which taught us that these words of moral evaluation of a war had no proper descriptive use and no objective meaning. Moral discourse was excluded from the world of science, even of social science. Okay, he's right on that. But then look at the next part. Yet I am by no means sure what the foundations of morality are. So he wants to formulate a just war theory and tells us in the beginning, I don't really know what the foundations of morality are, and yet I want to come up with a moral foundation for just war. The secular liberal attempt to establish, and there are conservative versions of this, I think often more among libertarian thinkers and utilitarian kind of approaches. But the attempt to do this without natural law, without God, is subject to the Nietzschean postmodern critique. If God is dead, isn't this just will to power? Here's an example. The Martin's Clause of the 1899 Hague Convention's preamble defines a war crime as the laws of humanity and the requirements of public conscience. Some people put this in terms of acts that shock our conscience. Those are things that are war crimes, right? Isn't this just relativism in disguise? I mean, who decides whether or not it shocks? Is it my conscience? Is it the will, the majority? We vote on this. So it wants to say there is something there that you can't violate, but it struggles to convey what it is. I'd encourage you to look up the notion of supreme emergency, in which such secular thinkers as Walzer, and then John Rawls, if you maybe have read him, think that moral norms break down and one should get one's hands dirty in order to defend the nation. I think what we're seeing here is that we can't provide a moral foundation for war if we remove God from the equation. And on secular terms, there really can't be a common good, as Father Aquinas meant that term, as we mean this term. There really isn't a common good. Without God, there cannot be an end for which we, in united action, strive. I would argue that all such attempts are doomed to fail, and so the need for a just war theory, and there's, I think, nearly universal agreement on that, points toward the need for a morality rooted in the natural law, discovered by the classical tradition, elaborated and built upon by the Catholic intellectual tradition. The Catholic just war theory is really the only option today. The attempt to promote justice or base justice on agreement, conventions, international law, merely reproduces the conditions of the early modern shift from natural law and Christian thinking to a legalism that eventually gave way to realism and relativism. We're just going to keep repeating that same situation. But that being said, there are difficult questions to be answered in the Catholic tradition as applied to today's conditions. For example, and this is that next quote, 6b, this is the Catechism's definition of just war. The strict conditions for legitimate defense by military force requires rigorous consideration. The gravity of such a decision makes it subject to rigorous conditions of moral legitimacy at one and the same time. The damage inflicted by the aggressor on the nation or community of nations must be lasting, grave, and certain. All our means of putting an end to it must have been shown to be impractical or ineffective. There must be serious prospects of success. The use of arms must not produce evils and disorders graver than the evil to be eliminated. The power of modern means of destruction weighs very heavily in evaluating this condition. So let's just try to raise some questions about that definition. Does this definition suggest that only defensive wars are legitimate, as many people argue today? And I should mention, too, the U.S. bishops in 1983 issued the Challenge of Peace and used this term presumption against war, which comes from a modern kind of duty-based ethic that is an alternative to the natural law approach. So that one's even more difficult to see, is it compatible with what the scholastic tradition developed? Is it saying, the Catechism saying, that retributive warfare, you've done a wrong, and we are engaged in an act of justice in punishing those who have failed to make redress after our attempts to appeal to their reason and their justice, is this not acceptable? And maybe so, that last sentence is saying, because of nuclear weaponry. You know, that the danger is so great that we have to tolerate more evils than we would have were it not for the weaponry we have today. Well, what about preemptive strikes? Are those always and everywhere wrong? The measure that's used in international law generally is called the Caroline Test. It was named after an incident in which a Canadian military unit attacked in U.S. territory an American civilian vessel. Most Americans know like no Canadian history. I mean, I'm in that category too. There was evidently a rebellion in the 1830s, I think it was, against the Canadian government. And so it was in the context of this, that what was happening was the Caroline was assisting the rebels. Okay. Daniel Webster formulated a stringent requirement in response and criticism for preemptive strike that's still used. Quote, instant, overwhelming, and leaving no choice of means and no moment for deliberation. That you have to establish that that was the situation. There was no other thing I could do. We had to act. In 2002, the Bush administration instead used the term grave and gathering danger, which is broader, right? So is preemptive strike always wrong? It does seem like if our enemy is developing nuclear weaponry, we can't wait until they attack. That's kind of, you know, these are the considerations. That's not clear. If we look back at Aquinas' second criterion, some fault or avenging wrongs, does seem to be allowed. We could think, for example, of threatening someone's well-being, like stalkers, that we don't have to wait until you've actually done the deed. The fact that you've created an unsafe, unsettling situation for people can itself be a fault, right? That's a fault. So that's something we need to think through. What about right intention? Notice that that passage, unless I missed it, does not talk about right intention. What happened to that? It seems that those arguing for today what they call the right after the war, the things we do in the war have to be compatible with peace after the war. That's, they want to add a third category. I would argue that it's already there in right intention, and the fact that right intention is kind of faded away, because it kind of seems like, how do I know if any of you intend rightly what you're doing, even if you follow the law, is very important to focus on. So then finally, what is the role of the church in all of this? Returning to the history we provided, is the idea of a holy war completely rejected by Christianity? Or is it a category of very limited application? Let's look at Aquinas on this briefly. How are we doing on time? I kind of lost track of...
10 minutes.
Okay, good. Oh, this part's really interesting. And it's kind of an aside, but I think it's one of those, it's like a quad libital that we'll do tomorrow. Here, quote C, it's a long one there. Aquinas asked this question. At the end of the Secunda Secundae, he's talking about states of life. What's the best way of life, you know, here? And it gets into religious orders. The Dominicans end up very high on this, not surprising. Dominicans are high. There's one higher than the Dominican, which we could talk about at another point. But the lowest, one of the lowest, is the religious order ordered towards soldiering. Could there be monks, friars, he doesn't talk about nuns or religious sisters, but could we ask that too, who take a vow to take up physical arms, not spiritual arms, in defense of the church? That's the question. And if the answer were yes, would it just be an historical, you know, crusades, not something still relevant to today? Aquinas argues, and I'm not going to read the whole passage there, that the answer is yes, that there could be a religious order, you know, Knight Templars or someone else, who have as their charism, and let's read that last, just before the reply to objection 4. He says, hence a religious order may be fittingly established for soldiering, not indeed for any worldly purpose, but for the defense of divine worship and public safety. So notice that it's a different purpose for it. Or also of the poor and oppressed, following Psalm 81. Aquinas goes on to say in reply to objection 4, the establishment of a religious order for the purpose of soldiering does not imply that the religious can wage war on their own authority. So we're not talking about, you know, that the, whatever this order, it'd be good to come up with a name for these monks and friars and nuns, their order, the Order of St. Michael, I guess, that they could declare war on their own. No, I'm not saying that. But by whose authority would they declare it then? The sovereign or the church, Aquinas says. The church then could authorize them in using violence in defense of worship, public safety, the poor, and the oppressed. So again, I mean, do you think Aquinas is just, that's a historical reality of the Crusades? Aquinas really doesn't talk about the Crusades. That's another thing we wish he would have told us more about, what he thinks on that. Would that be legitimate? Right? Would this be something we could have today? And if so, what would that look like? And I have some examples that I'm going to defend that this could still happen today. And if you want to push on that. Okay. Finally, I want to conclude with a reminder of this central point, as we see in the final quote on the handout. For any war to be just, we must not impose our will on others, but seek their good when their wickedness imposes upon us the awful duty of bringing their good about by violence. D. Justice is a habit whereby a man renders to each one his due by a constant and perpetual will. In war, we must will the good not only of those who we are defending, but even of those we are attacking. For we will their salvation, and we seek their restoration in the universal common good that we all have in common, whatever nation we're a part of, God. As hard as this may be, we must somehow prepare our hearts to see the image and likeness of God, and even him who we must, as a last resort, send to his Maker. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.